Now, back to your turn on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. The phone lines are open, so call in and join the conversation at 623-1330.
Thank you so much for tuning in. If you've just tuned in, my name's Renee Giacchino. I'm corporate counsel for the Center for Individual Freedom. To learn more about my organization, please visit our website at www.cfif.org. If you happen to miss any of the Your Turn programs that I host, please feel free to click on the Freedom Line picture there that's up, and you can listen to any of the prior interviews that we've conducted right here on 1330 WEBY, or if you just want to listen to another one over again, you can go ahead and do it that way. Well, we've covered a lot of different issues today. We talked about the local issue, the plight of our zoo, the Zoo Northwest Florida. Then with the Home Run Derby happening tonight in Major League Baseball and the All-Star Game tomorrow night, we were joined by ESPN columnist Mark Creedler to talk about his new book called Six Good Innings, and I will try and get him back. I know we had to cut that interview a little bit short. We had a lot of folks who still had some follow-up questions. Because we wanted to make sure that we had time for Quinn Hillier, who came on to talk with us about the economy and inside baseball in Washington, D.C. Well, probably there's another issue that's on everyone's minds these days, and that's right. You've guessed it. It's energy. And joining us now is Myron Ebel. He's coming on the program to talk with us about the issue of energy and what's happening in and around our world as certainly world leaders meet at the G8 summit and what that may mean for us. Please welcome back to Your Turn, Myron Ebel. He is with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's the Director of Global Warming and Energy Policy for the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Thanks so much for joining us again, Myron.
Thanks for having me.
And I think I mispronounce your last name every time you come on. Will you please?
It doesn't matter. don't worry about it. I pronounce it Ebel, but you can
Ebel.
Pronounce it any way you want.
Well,
like.
From now on, I will say Ebel. Mine's Giacchino, and that gets butchered probably a lot more than yours, but it's still not right, so I apologize.
That's fine.
Tell us, if you will, first of all, tell us, for the folks maybe who haven't had the pleasure of listening to you in the past, what it is that you do as the Director of Global Warming and Energy Policy for the Competitive Enterprise Institute. What's that program?
Well, we're a public policy institute that's nonprofit and nonpartisan, and we work on regulatory and red tape issues from a free market perspective. So we push market solutions to our energy problems rather than getting the government involved and spending a lot of taxpayer money on one kind of energy rather than another. And so we have a lot to do right now because there's, everybody in the world that produces some kind of energy that isn't competitive, they claim if they get a government handout, it will suddenly become competitive. So, and then, of course, we have here in Congress now a tremendous battle going on over whether we should actually produce more petroleum in this country or whether we should keep it locked up. And so that's keeping us fairly busy.
If folks want to learn more about your organization, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, how can they do that?
CEI.org.
Okay,
you'll find us on the web.
Okay, CEI.org. Remember the ORG for organization. All right, let's talk about this announcement that just came out a couple of days ago. The G8 summit leaders wish for painful 50% emissions reduction. What's so painful about that?
Well, the G8 summit agreed that they would push for an agreement to reduce our global greenhouse gas emissions by 50% by the year 2050. Now, what's painful about that is that the world gets 85% of its energy from coal, oil, and natural gas, the things that when you burn them produce carbon dioxide. They produce a lot of carbon dioxide. If you burn a ton of coal, you're going to produce more than 3.5 tons of carbon dioxide and put it into the air. And there has, of course, been a long effort to describe this as pollution, but carbon dioxide is a naturally occurring, tasteless, odorless substance that's part of the atmosphere whether we're burning coal or not. But we can't simply change the world energy economy when we get 85% of our energy, and we, by the way, in the United States get 85% of our energy from those three sources as well. So we're just average, according to the world usage. We can't switch that in 42 years. There is the investments that are in coal-fired power plants, in gas propelled automobiles, we can switch some of that. But if we try to really knock back our use of our major energy sources, what we're going to do is end up with a lot less energy, even though we've got a growing population in the world that needs more energy. So I think it would be like going on a very severe diet really a starvation diet and saying, well, we know it's good for us. But in fact, of course, the outcome will be very, very detrimental to most people in the world in terms of their standard of living, and particularly to poor people, hundreds of millions of poor people in the world who don't even have electricity.
So you're talking about the really where we would see where it would be most painful would be from an economic standpoint.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, reach the 50% target, the United States would have to be pretty close to 100%. So we would have to get rid of 85% of where we get our energy from and find new sources, and plus the addition that we're going to need with a growing population and a growing economy. It's just not possible because every other source of energy is considerably more expensive than coal, oil, and natural gas. So what we would end up with is we would be telling people you have to use a lot less energy. If you have two cars now, you better get a motorbike. If you have one car now, you better walk. If you heat and cool all the rooms of your house, maybe you better get used to heating and cooling one or two of them. That's really the kind of change we would be looking at. Because to give you an example, people keep talking about, well, there are these alternatives like wind power. Wind power is incredibly expensive compared to a coal-fired power plant. No one would build wind power if the government didn't both mandate wind power and subsidize wind power. And the subsidies are huge, and even with the subsidies, no one would build windmills if it wasn't required by certain state governments that a certain percentage of the power come from wind power. So, yeah, it's a source, but it's a very expensive source.
Well, if as indicated in this article, the leaders at the G8 summit are seeking at least a 50% reduction in carbon emissions by 2050, and if that's overly aggressive and would in fact, cripple our economy and the economies of most nations, is there something lower that should and could be considered, or is this sort of an all or nothing, 50% or nothing? I mean, or is this just
question.
A debate we shouldn't even be having, do you think?
Well, I think two things. First of all, the environmental groups will not accept just a 50% cut. They say we need a more like an 80% cut. On the other hand, China and India and the other major developing economies had a meeting right after the G8 summit with the G8 leaders, including President Bush and the European leaders and Japan and so on. And the Chinese and Indians just said simply, no, we will not sign on to this. If you think global warming is a big problem, you guys take the responsibility and you make the cuts, because we have to have growing economies, because we have poor people and who don't have cars, who don't have electricity, we need that power. You know, if you want to do it, go ahead. Now, in terms of should we be doing something? Well, I think we need to understand what is the threat that global warming presents. The world has warmed up a little bit since about 1850, and so far the consequences have been fairly minor and modest and good. I think mostly good. Is the world going to continue to warm up as we burn more coal and oil and natural gas? Maybe. But is the rate of warming something to worry about, or is the end point how much warming there'll be something to worry about? I don't think so. The Kyoto Global Warming Treaty was negotiated in 1997, and since then, carbon dioxide levels have gone up about 5%, up to about 385 parts per million. So it's still less than 0.4% of the atmosphere. And the global average temperature has remained flat. And in fact, this year looks fairly cool. It looks like it's going to be one of the colder years we've had recently. So I don't think the rate of warming is very significant. And so this is a long answer to a simple question. But I think if global warming does turn out to be a problem, the way we will solve it is through new technology over time. I don't think this is a 10 or 20 or 30-year problem. If it's a problem at all, it's probably a 100 or a 200-year problem. And in 100 years, we have no idea what kind of energy we'll be using. Go back 150 50 years when people were still, horsepower was still running the country. I mean, nobody could have imagined what we have, and I don't think we should try to imagine what people will have in 100 years.
Tell me, is there some truth to the fact that, I mean, a lot of folks in this debate about global warming and climate control and all of that say, you know, we are truly just in a trend, that we have been in a trend of late of global warming, if that's what you want to call it. But when you look back over the years, there have been trends of global cooling, too. And as you indicated, this may end up being a year maybe off the trend where we will have global cooling. Is there data to support that?
Yes, I think it's a very complicated question because there are a number of natural cycles, and they both, you know, when everything is in cycle, you'll get a very strong trend, and when the cycles are running against each other, they'll kind of even out. And some of these cycles are very long. There's a 1,500-year solar cycle that's fairly well known. There's an 11-year sunspot cycle that's fairly well known, or 22 years. We're now, it looks like, entering a new a sunspot cycle, and it looks like, because the way it's very slow in getting started, in fact, people thought it would get started about 2 years ago, and it really isn't going yet. The history shows that when sunspot cycles start very slowly, they're very weak, and that suggests that we're in for some cooling over the next decade. And I think people, you know, who are investing a lot in global warming and saying, oh, boy, I'm going to make a killing on all this stuff because we're going to pass a lot of global warming laws, I think they may be disappointed because global cooling may convince people that maybe now is not the right time to turn on the air conditioning.
And when you talk about passing global warming laws, I mean, they sneak their way in the back door, can't they? Let's talk about one very recently. And, I mean, this is, you know, my son's favorite animal, the polar bear. But the polar bear being added to the list of threatened species in the U.S., give me your thoughts on that.
Well, the Endangered Species Act is written in such a way that once somebody makes a claim that something might be endangered, it's very difficult not to list it. And the polar bear is an interesting example of this, the power the tendency of the law to want to list anything that is proposed for listing, in that polar bear populations, well, since 1950, human populations have gone up about 300%, and we call that a population explosion. Polar bear populations have gone up about 500%, and we say that they're in threat of extinction. It's hard to understand how the bear can be threatened if its population keeps going up.
Well, aren't we threatened then under that argument? I'd like to threaten a few, but go on.
I think that the polar bear listing will... The Endangered Species Act is not designed to save endangered wildlife. It's designed to create regulatory mischief where people want to create it. So it's usually used to stop development projects. For example, in Southern California, a lot of insects have been listed in order to stop real estate development. If you're a favored company or a favored industry, the environmental groups may not file suit when you want to do something. But if you're not favored and you haven't paid large sums of contributions to the local environmental groups, and you want to do something with your land or you want to buy some land and build something, they're likely to file a suit and say you can't do that because we have an endangered species here, or we have potential habitat for an endangered species. Maybe there aren't any here, but they could live on this land if you didn't build a shopping center or a subdivision. With the polar bear, they will be able to use this against any new manufacturing facility, any new thing that consumes energy like a shopping center or a highway, or any new power plant that uses coal, oil, or natural gas. They'll come in and say, you can't build that natural gas plant here. Why? Well, it will create carbon dioxide emissions, which cause global warming, which causes the Arctic to melt, which threatens the polar bear. So I think it will be used in very mischievous ways, and I think that was really, as I said, the purpose of the Endangered Species Act is not to protect wildlife, it's to cause regulatory mischief.
Yeah, they're getting very, very creative.
Yes.
All right, Myron, we need to take a real quick break. We've got a couple minutes left. If you've got a question for Myron, please feel free to call in at 850-623-1330. We are talking with Myron Ebell. He directs the Energy and Global Warming Policy for the Competitive Enterprise Institute. To learn more about his organization, visit them on the web at CEI.org. We'll be right back after this short break. Please stay tuned.
Now, back to your turn on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. The phone lines are open, so call in and join the conversation at 623-1330.
There are just about 5 minutes left in this segment, and we are talking to Myron Ebell. He's the Director of Energy and Global Warming Policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He also chairs the Cooler Heads Coalition, which comprises of over two dozen nonprofit groups in the country and abroad that question global warming alarmism and oppose energy rationing policies. You have a column that you wrote a couple of months ago about the Climate Security Act, and they were talking points on the Lieberman-Warner energy rationing bill, and folks can read about that at CEI.org. Are you guys going to be putting anything up, sort of a report card on congressional members and then the presidential candidates that'll help us to try and figure out what their position may be on this issue of climate change?
No. we try to stay as far away from partisan politics as we can. As a 501c3 nonprofit, we really have to be very careful. What I would say is, if you're interested in where your senators and your member of Congress are on these issues, ask them, did you vote to open ANWR in Alaska to oil drilling? Or did you vote to open the offshore areas to oil and gas drilling? I know that's a touchy subject in Florida, but I think the evidence is very strongly in favor of the legislation that was passed 2 years ago and that has been bottled up in this Congress by the Democratic leadership. The bill would have allowed drilling, for example, in the eastern Gulf of Mexico, but the state of Florida would be able to prevent it within 125 miles of your coast. Now, the Cubans are calling in the Chinese and the Venezuelans, and they're going to be drilling a lot closer than 125 miles to the Florida Keys. They'll be within about 40 miles, I believe. So another thing is, ask your senator, how did you vote on the Lieberman-Warner global warming bill? That is another kind of indication. You know, if you vote against opening up our offshore areas and areas in Alaska to oil and gas drilling, what you're saying is you think the gas prices are about right, or maybe they're not high enough. And so that's why I think that's a good question to ask your elected leaders.
Well, the news reports out today are obviously that gas prices are going up again. I mean, forecasters, folks at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, do you guys see a ceiling at all on this?
I think the price of crude oil is likely to either go up or down. It's very hard to anticipate the market on this. On the one hand, if anything goes wrong in the world supply, the reason the price is so high is because the demand is high and the supply system is stretched tight. And if anything goes wrong and politically with our relations with Iran, if there's some kind of blow up with Iran or Venezuela or a problem in Nigeria, the price of oil could go way up. On the other hand, if the world economy, for example, goes into some kind of recession because of high oil prices, one of the main reasons that it would be doing that right now, and then I think the price of oil could go down considerably. But I wouldn't want to speculate about which one of those is going to happen.
Well, and I know there are a lot of folks out there who can't imagine that they're going to go down anytime soon. In fact, you know, I've heard a lot of people say that don't be surprised if, you know, by election time we're not paying $5 a gallon. Hope that's not true. But like you said, they could go up and they could go down. My money's on them going up, unfortunately.
Well, you know, if the Congress were forced by the public now to vote, you know, the Democratic leadership in both the House and the Senate is doing everything they can to prevent a vote on opening up our offshore areas to oil and gas exploration. If the Congress voted that this summer and they sent it to the president, who is eager to sign it, prices would go down. I don't know how much, but just knowing that more supplies are on the way from a stable part of the world, the United States, would reassure the market about there's a risk premium built into the price. So I think the one thing that could definitely drive prices down right now would be to open up 85% of our offshore areas are closed to oil and gas exploration by congressional moratorium. So if Congress got rid of that moratorium and said, yes, the oil companies can go in and look for oil, and potentially, you know, there's a huge amount of oil not only in the Eastern Gulf but off the coast of Southern California, there may be even a lot more. So I think that would have a definite effect on the market almost immediately.
What about these numbers that they throw about inshore? I mean, that there's significant supplies inshore, and we've got about a minute left.
Well, there are new fields that are being discovered. The Democrats in Congress are now trying to say, well, the oil companies aren't exploiting the areas that are already open to leasing. Well, that's because there isn't any oil there. You know, if you drill a well and you find out that there's no oil, you're not going to continue to drill the area that you've leased. So I think a lot of what's going on now is this political dance. There's one faction that says, no, we cannot permit more oil production in this country. We're going to have to import more and more of our oil. And there's another faction that says, you know, this will really help. And I'm on the help side. I think if we want to use so much energy, we ought to be willing to produce more of it.
All right. Well, Myron, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it. We love having you as a guest on the program and hope you'll join us again soon.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. We've been talking with Myron Ebell. He's the Director of Global Warming and Energy Policy for the Competitive Enterprise Institute. As I mentioned, to learn more about his organization, visit them on the web at www.cfif.org. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'll be back again in 2 weeks. Hope you'll tune in then, as you do every day. Have a good evening.